The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, it's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here. Welcome to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. This is just a note to say that if you are hearing this, then you are not currently part of my membership programme and will only be hearing the first part of each show. In order to access full episodes of the Tudor History and Travel Show, you will need to become a member of my membership site, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England, via the link in the description associated with this podcast. Now, some of you may know that the 1st of March marks the patron saint day of St David of Wales. And so it is very fitting that in this episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show, we should be returning to Pembrokeshire to visit St David's Cathedral, which of course is dedicated to their patron saint. As you will hear at the top of this podcast, this particular episode was over 3 years in the making, but I finally made it and met up with our guide for today, Mary James, who is the curator and archivist of the cathedral there in St David's, which, by the way, is an absolutely gorgeous little city. It's actually the smallest city in the UK, and it's in fact more like a village. But if you ever do get to Pembrokeshire, I urge you to go and visit this historic spot. It is beautiful and utterly charming. As ever, there will be a show notes page to accompany this podcast. And in the show notes page, there will be some brief text describing the history of St David, as well as some of the pictures that we took while we were there on location. So if you want to look at some of the things we are talking about, then make sure you check out the link in the description associated with this podcast and make your way over to the show notes page. The other thing I want to mention before we get underway is a slight apology. You will hear at the beginning of this podcast that I talk about this episode following on from my previous episode at Pembrokeshire Castle. Now, in the end, I have moved the order of the episodes around a little bit. And of course, we had Pembrokeshire in January. So it is not following directly on from that. So I don't want you to be confused. So my apologies on that. However, of course, this does not detract from the fact we have a fantastic episode ahead of us. Mary is a superb guide, and it was a real treat to tour the cathedral with her at our side. So I hope you enjoy the smorgasbord of delights that lie ahead of us. So I think without any further ado, we need to time travel, whizzing across to St David's Cathedral in Pembrokeshire to meet up with our guide today. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Mary James and the wonderful and sublime St David's Cathedral. Hello, dear listeners. You join me on my pilgrimage in Wales. If you listened to last month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show, you will know that in the summer, I was on my own pilgrimage to some of the most important Tudor places in Wales. And in the last episode, we were at Pembroke Castle. And today, I've come a little further afield to a place again that I've been planning to come to for, I don't know, 3 or more years, certainly since I first was in conversation with our guide and guest today. And that's Mary. Hello. Hello, Mary. Welcome to the Tudor History and Travel Show.
Hello. Croeso I ti ddewi, Sarah.
Oh, my goodness.
Welcome to St David's.
That's so lovely. It's so lovely to hear Welsh
have spoken. Oh, well, thank you so much. I know we struck up a conversation, as I said, about 3 years, pre-pandemic. And I've been dying to get here. And again, once again, dear listeners, we have been blessed with the most beautiful, sunny summer's day. St. David's is a total delight. What an amazing church. And you may hear that we are actually in the church, and I would just say, for those of you tuning in, it's open to the public today, so you will be hearing sounds of people moving around and enjoying this gorgeous cathedral. But before we get into the history, and we'll be talking about the history of the cathedral, why a cathedral is here today, and of course then moving on to some of the most important Tudor aspects of its history, Mary, I'd love you just to not only introduce yourself, but tell folk what association do you have with the cathedral?
Well, I'm Mary James, and I look after the library in St. David's Cathedral and the artefacts and the collections, and share the stories of them with people, whether it's just having open library a couple of times a week, or doing tours of it, or arranging for loaning different artefacts out to other people who want to share them as well, and bringing things in here. So it's a lovely opportunity to be able to just talk to people about the 1400 years of history here, which is always amazing. And we're always finding out new things as well about the cathedral.
Well, we are going to be finding out a lot of new things today. I am certainly going to be finding out a lot of new things. And you've got some real treats in store for us today, haven't you? You're going to be taking us to see some really interesting artefacts, as well as talking about the history of this place. What have you got in store for us here? What do you say are our highlights?
Well, some of the things, apparently you only want to talk for about an hour and a half, which is very difficult indeed. Some of the things I think that we'll make sure that we can look at today and talk about is the founder of the Tudor dynasty, who is buried here, and how he came to be buried here. We'll look at what was the big Welsh Reformation project, which was implementing a vision by Elizabeth I, which is really exciting, and that resonated all around Wales and was absolutely key to maintaining the Welsh language. So we'll look at that and what that is. And then we'll also at least talk about some of the music that they would have heard here at the time. One of the key Tudor composers of sacred music was born here. And we still, our choir still sing his music, and our organist still play his music. And that is special, that sort of continuity of time. You know, you and others sometimes say that we're divided from the past by time, but not by space.
Absolutely.
So as we go around the building, lots of these things will just sort of, oh, and that used to be, and during the Reformation, and before the Reformation, and after the Reformation. So so many things in the building that will be of interest.
If we're lucky, we might just get to hear some of this music played. So let's see what happens as the day unfolds. Now, we are starting our conversation in the middle of the nave of the church. And I'd love to talk about two things. I'd love to talk about, first of all, how this cathedral came to be here and who was St. David. And where are we, actually? That's another good place. For those people who are overseas, not sure of the geography, we should start with where we are. And then I'd love to find out, as I said, about the history of the cathedral, why it's here, and some of the fantastic architecture that surrounds us. And I should just say, dear listeners, as ever, there will be a show notes page associated with this podcast. We'll be taking lots of pictures as we go around. So if you want to see some of the things that Mary and I are going to be talking about, make sure that you click on the link in the description associated with the podcast. So, Mary, where are we in the world?
Well, the centre of it, of course. What a question. So we're in the far southwest corner of Wales. Wales is currently part of the United Kingdom, so we're on the western edge of Europe. And we're here because in the 6th century, so in the 500s, Dewi Sant, St. David, came here because it was remote, It was quiet, it was boggy, it was awkward, and he was an aesthete, and he had become a monk probably by then, although it wasn't the same language and vocabulary. And he wanted to come to a place that was remote and where he could have spiritual space. But he also wanted to have access to the rest of the world. So it's important that it's by a river, that it's by the sea, because he was, in effect, then across the road from Ireland. Lots of travel back and forth between here and Ireland in the 6th century. It wasn't quite a motorway service station of the 6th century, but sometimes, you know, we can think of it like that. Lots of travel back and forth to Cornwall, to Brittany, to Normandy, which became important because it meant that people in Normandy and in Brittany knew of St. David and recognised him as a saint. And then also it was virtually around the corner and down the road from the Mediterranean. And there are reports that David went to Jerusalem at least once in the 6th century. And we thought that might be pushing it a bit. But this year, the Patriarch of Jerusalem has actually confirmed that that's highly likely. And he has absolutely no doubts that David came in the 6th century.
Oh, fantastic.
So we're very central, but also quite remote.
What did David do to become Saint David?
That's a very good question. And I think probably the best answer is that he was a holy man. Celtic saints, there wasn't the sort of bureaucracy that you go through in the Catholic Church, so they weren't canonised as such. So in 1123, for instance, when Pope Calixtus recognised that two visits to St. David's had the same advantage of benediction of one visit to Rome, that wasn't a canonisation. That was an international recognition of an existing sainthood. So David was born here. He was then educated. The reports are that he was educated in the scriptures. He was educated to be a holy man and to become a monk, really. Probably slightly further north than here, in Llanbadarn and Manoy and places in Cardiganshire. His father was probably the king of Ceredigion, of Cardiganshire, in Mid Wales, and then David had a group of we would call them monks around him. So there was here and he came to this really remote place, probably the last one who came here when it was really quiet, and he then had a group around him, and they would be praying, and the description of their life is what we would say of a monastic life. That they would pray several times a day, and to emphasise the effect of the prayer, he would stand in cold water while praying, and especially after his morning prayers. Well, a lot of people would think that was completely nuts, but actually, cold water swimming is a big mindfulness thing now, so people are doing that again. Exactly. And there are several reports of his life that are very, very similar. So although there was nothing written down in the 6th century, and nobody took photographs, really annoying, by the 12th century, there were several lives of the saints being written, really because that was a transitional period and the Normans were coming in at that stage, so you write the history of your own country before anybody else tries to change the story, kind of thing. Those are the sort of things that we know about David. We know a certain amount about his life here, but that's why we're here, because then after he died here, all the reports are, the community that he'd set up stayed here. Other people came to join it. His body, his bones, his relics were here. And the tradition at the time in the Celtic Christian Church, much like the Orthodox Church at the moment, is that relics of saints were peripatetic. They were taken around. So although they were based here, they were taken around. And there are stories that the Welsh never went into battle if they didn't have the bones of David with them. You know, it's a failsafe kind of thing. And it wasn't until the Middle Ages, until the 12th, 13th century, that shrines were built, physical shrines, and we'll come on to that. And then pilgrimage became about a destination.
Yeah.
You were making a pilgrimage to a destination.
So before we get on to talk about the Tudor history, you've brought up the shrine. And actually, when we were talking pre-recording, you said, oh, we've still got it. And I was like, what? You've still got a medieval shrine? Because I have to say, I've been all over the place and I haven't actually yet come across, apart from the one at Westminster Abbey, which you can't get access to, I've never been to a shrine. But I'm wondering, since we're talking about shrines and pilgrimage, that maybe we should just go and have a quick look at it.
Certainly, yes.
Should we do that?
Absolutely. Yeah,
let's just go. That. Yeah. Excellent. So we've come up through the nave, through the chancel, to the shrine. So can you describe, Mary, what's in front of us here?
Well, this is the shrine of St David. It was built, from what we can tell, from about 1274, when David's body and bones, as far as we know, were put into the shrine, and then that became a destination for pilgrimage. It's like all medieval shrines, it's three tiers, which is really copying the design of the sepulchre in Jerusalem. So the bottom tier that we see here, there are three large arches. Those are the prayer niches. And that is where pilgrims would have prayed. And the references in Chaucer and the other writings are that pilgrims came and communed with the saint, prayed close to the saint. And then the two levels above, the immediate level above, where there are quatrefoil holes in the wall, as it were, those are called the offertory niches. And the offerings were of prayers, but they were also of money.
Ah, yes.
So there were two areas of offerings there. And in these offertory niches, people will still put prayers, and we have a facility for putting prayers there, and they will be prayed at evening prayer that day. And we have prayers at the shrine every Friday, weekly, and they're live streamed, so people from all over the world join us at the Shrine of St David. And then the third tier is the depiction of the saints, and those are the parts that would have been really highly decorated on many of the medieval shrines. That's where the gold and the jewelled aerials were. But in many ways, the most important part are these prayer niches, and they were important because that's where the pilgrims, when they came here, would have taken part, and they would have become part of the whole atmosphere of Dewi and the experience. So, come on, Sarah, I think you should try this. So, we haven't got a medieval pilgrim here, so we've got kneelers out in front, and people are entitled to pray here all the time. So, if you just kneel down and put your head close up to there, and see if there's something slightly different.
So I kneel. Oh my goodness! Yes, it is, isn't it? So I'm kneeling right down on the cushion. I've got my head inside this little alcove. It's my own little private prayer alcove. So I can put my hands together and say, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done, as earth as it is on heaven." Well, it's a really lovely acoustic in there. I don't know what our lovely sound of it.
We couldn't hear.
Could you not hear?
No.
It was really private.
Yeah.
That's really good, isn't it?
But Dewi would have heard you in there, probably.
Dewi heard me.
I'll just say one more little prayer. Bring blessings to this podcast, St David. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
What was that?
You couldn't hear?
No.
That's incredible, isn't it?
I asked St David to bless the podcast.
Oh, there we are. And the interesting thing, I mean, that's quite mystical, and it's quite special.
It is.
And if it's that for us, imagine what it would have been like.
It would have been
for
amazing.
For those medieval pilgrims coming here.
Such an experience, because you've done all the walking, of course. You know, you don't just turn up like we did in the car today, and it was really simple. You've done all that walking to get here, and then what a moment to sit and pray.
And you're there with the saint. That's what they believe.
So his bones are still in there? Don't know.
but the interesting thing, you said you'd never seen a medieval shrine before.
Yeah.
We think what happened was that it was quite early in the Reformation that Bishop Barlow, an English Protestant bishop, was sent here to stop pilgrimages. So to just ban pilgrimages, to take all the paint off didn't destroy the actual shrine, because what was important to them then was just stopping the pilgrimages, which they did.
Yeah.
Then we'll go and look at something that was moved here that probably stopped further destruction here.
Right.
So the shrine itself was never destroyed. But later, as we think, as they began to understand the effect of that acoustic, the only way to get rid of that acoustic was to destroy the whole lot.
Yeah.
Destroy the whole lot. Yeah. So elsewhere, they were destroyed. And for all we know, it was just, we're not going all the way back to St. David's to destroy that one there, or forgot about it, or what, we don't know. But the timeline seems to suggest that pilgrimages were banned early on.
Yeah.
In the Tudor period, in the Tudor Reformation period, but that the shrine itself wasn't.
Oh, thank you so much. That is a first for me. So wonderful. I can now say I've prayed at a medieval shrine. How fantastic. Before we go on, I think we should go and actually go back and look at some of the architecture, and just because we talked a little bit about the history and how the cathedral came to be here, but I'd love to talk a little bit about the architecture, because one of the things that I noticed when I came through the door was like, wow, it's got a beautiful feel in here, and there's some amazing architecture. Very Normanesque, I think, but you're going to put me right if I'm wrong. So maybe we could just go back and back through the chancel.
Okay, no, don't worry.
We retraced our steps a little bit because we moved away from the nave to go and visit the shrine. But I really wanted to spend a bit of time with you, Mary, talking about the architecture that you can see here. Can you describe some of the main features and what it says about the date of the building?
Well, we talked about St. David being here in the 6th century. And there were churches and chapels and various cells around the whole valley area, and we've got we found carved stone crosses and things from that period, from quite early period. But we also talked about how there were other places across the seas that Dewi went to and that recognised David. Mm-hmm. And part of that was Normandy. And so when the Normans invaded England, they came to St. David's on pilgrimage. So William I, known as William the Conqueror, came here, and the medieval Welsh annals say Am Perenindod. Now, Perenindod is the word that we still use for pilgrimage. Uh-huh. So William I came here on pilgrimage to St. David, and then he went away again. He had quite a large army with him, but there was no attempt at military conquest at that time. Then the next Norman king to visit was Henry II. Was of course the bully boy Norman villain of the Thomas Becket story. Mm-hmm. But he already had form here because he had blocked the appointment as bishop of one of the sort of favourite sons of the diocese, called Gerald Gumro, Gerald the Welshman, who wrote profusely, I'm pleased to say, so we've got lots of records. He wrote in Latin and was known as Geraldus Cambrensis. And Henry II came here within months of the murder of Becket, as part of his penance. He was given a sort of penance of many parts over many years. And he came here twice. And the medieval Welsh annalist Brita Tywysogion, Chronicles of the Princes, Brita Tywysogion, say that he came am Perenindod on pilgrimage, and that he left money here, and he left gifts for the singers to God and St David. So in 1171, there was a report of singers here to God and St David.
Fantastic.
The money that he left was probably to expand an already existing basin and chapel, as we would call it, to Thomas Becket. Henry II then appointed a bishop here, who the week before had been a French monk in Shropshire, called Peter Lee, in French, Peter de Leyer. And at that time then, the building of this cathedral started. Well, actually, there was probably a smaller one, and then they thought, we need a bigger cathedral because of the pilgrims who were coming. So what we're looking at now is mostly what was built in 1181.
That's amazing. It's in such fantastic condition, but it's got all the dogtooth, the sword dogtooth arches, hasn't it, the Normanesque arches.
So it's got the classically recognised rounded arches.
Yeah.
Of Norman architecture, but they're not plain Norman arches. As you say, it's got the decoration on it,
yeah,
in the carved stonework, and each archway is different.
Yes, it
all
is.
All of these patterns are different.
It?
Yeah, yeah.
And these contrast quite markedly with the ceiling, which is quite stunning, mm-hmm. I think, and very unusual. Tell us about the ceiling.
Well, the ceiling, all Norman cathedrals were built initially with wooden ceilings, and in most cases they were then replaced with stone ceilings. But here, they're still wooden ceilings because the cathedral is on a slope. And so the pressure of the stone on it would have been too much. And the reason it's on a slope is because it's in this valley, mm-hmm. and it's coming down to the river. So there was a wooden ceiling originally in 1181. We don't know exactly what happened to that. What we're looking at now is a replacement in the 16th century.
Uh-huh.
So the designs that you can see there, that you say it quite rightly, is quite exceptional. This was really Renaissance design.
Yes.
That was being brought in.
I can
here.
See the hanging pendants remind me of those in the Chapel Royal at Hampton Court.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the original ceiling here, at the 16th century ceiling, had no religious representation on it at all, which was exceptional. The reredos that we can see there and the crucifix, that was added later. The representation and the patterns on the pedestals that you can see coming from the ceiling there, the designs there, they're dolphins.
Oh, are they?
Yes, right, and okay. So they represent the sort of marine bases of it. Still dolphins you can see in the coast around here, just down the road. You can see the dolphins there.
I haven't seen any dolphins yet, but I'd like to.
There's a lot up there. And it is absolutely fabulous, I'm seeing. And when you think that it is... it is ceiling at the top of a very tall nave. So actually, all that beautiful, intricate carved, they knew that people wouldn't see it.
Yeah.
When they were creating it in the 16th century, they didn't know that we'd have telephoto lenses. They didn't know the kind of phones. They didn't know about phones, let alone photo phones.
Yeah.
That ceiling is quite amazing and is probably the only part of the cathedral that was never painted.
Right. Okay.
Because in 1181, what we now see as this lovely pale Carpudi stone would have been covered in paintings.
Yeah.
And there's quite a few medieval paintings that we can still see and that have been uncovered, and we've been looking at some. But the ceiling itself, there's no evidence it was ever painted. It was at that transitional period. So there was still some of the medieval feel about it, was coming into a medieval cathedral and going into the Reformation and the Tudor period, where there was a totally different design for cathedrals and churches and really wanting to get rid of all that fabulous paintwork and what we now think of as wonderful medieval wall paintings.
Yeah, wonderful. And do we know who made that ceiling? Who carved it?
Not entirely. No. In many cases, the names of workmen are just
gone
lost.
In this
we don't know about that. We think we might be able to see their faces in various places around the cathedral.
Uh-huh.
You'll see lots of faces in different places.
Yes, little carved faces.
Lots of little faces. And they're not necessarily of kings and bishops and important people. If they're of people at all, it would have been of the bloke carving next to you, yeah, or the other workman
you
around the corner.
You can imagine them saying, hey, look, yeah, here, yeah, look here, George, I've, yeah, carved your face.
Exactly, yeah, you'll be there for a few years, you know, like 1400.
That's
well,
fantastic.
Not quite 1400, 900, some of these. And all around the choir stalls here, tiny, tiny little faces. There's 60 of them there, and they're all different, tiny, tiny ones.
Wonderful.
And people can see those at any time.
We're sort of in the, I suppose, in the screen passage between that goes between the nave and the chancel at the moment, and there's some really beautiful old tombs of a different period, a different age, later medieval.
Yes, these are 14th century. So the nave 12th century and the 12th century cathedral goes up to just behind the current high altar. And then in the 14th century, there was another big period of ecclesiastical building, of church investment. And Bishop Gower represented that in this period. And he's buried here next to us.
Okay, so, yeah. So we've got some, this one we've got over some here, carved stone effigies on both, well, one to my left and two to my right as we speak. So these are the bishops.
Well, one of them is Bishop Gower, and you can see the representation of his mitre to indicate he was a bishop. And people can see as they walk past there, there's a lovely line of depiction of carved stone saints along the bishop's tomb. The one next to him, we don't quite know who he is. Well, we don't know who he is at all, in fact. He's obviously very holy because he's sitting there praying in a way the bishop isn't. He's probably the bishop's confessor or the bishop's chaplain. He's also got, have a look down here, he's got rather a nice Kutchy lion by his feet.
I love those heraldic beasts at their feet.
He looks very cosy down there.
He does, really.
And the one on the other side, we don't know who he is at all, but what has survived from his tomb are some absolutely glorious medieval paintings on the ceiling above the tomb.
Isn't it beautiful? The colours are so vibrant.
So there's a lion of St. Mark there. There's an eagle. Yeah. There's we think this is Mary. We're not sure. Okay. This could have been this is a crucifixion scene, maybe an ascension scene. There's a lot of red here, and some of the paintings that people can see as they walk past them. But often people walk past and don't notice them. Some of the paintings on the pillars in the nave. It's the red that's remained, and that's partly because the red ochre was a very strong vegetable dye that could be used and survives, but also because in this area that was the public area, this is where all of us were allowed to come, that represented the blood of Christ. So you were surrounded by the blood of Christ.
Thank you.
So, Mary, obviously you just said we've been in the public area of the church, which is the nave, and now we're moving up some stairs, which takes us into the chancel. So this is where the monks would have held their service.
This is where the monks would have been, where services and worship would have been carried out. And one of the things that's quite noticeable, that people can come to the red ropes at the end of the choir and see, if they look down into the nave, they'll see one of the medieval paintings up here, which is a charming wise owl in the middle.
He's beautiful.
And then with a chattering magpie on either side.
Yes.
And the idea of that, we think, is that it was a reminder to the clergy and the choir and the monks as they were coming from their sacred space into the more public area, that they might be the wise owls in the middle. But there were all the rest of us there asking them questions and reminding them of things. And
chattering. That's true.
And it's a charming painting. It's a lovely, lovely painting.
I love that painting. He's gorgeous, that owl. Okay, so we're moving into the sort of the choir area, as you said, the most sacred area of the church. So, immediately struck by, well, some beautiful carved stalls, but the ceiling again over the high altar, and oh my goodness, right above my head at the crossing. Is that all wood?
It's all wood. So there's three huge wooden ceilings. Some of it's original one, but a lot of it was replaced in the Gilbert Scott restoration period. We've had some dendrochronology work done on most of the ceilings, and it is a mixture of 12th century onwards.
Is it?
Which is amazing.
For those people who don't know, Gilbert Scott was a very, very famous, prominent.
Well, he was an architect. But he was specifically an ecclesiastical architect, and we were very lucky that. There was some destruction here in the Reformation, a lot during the Civil War, although the cathedral was used during the Civil War for worship, which a lot of them weren't. And then for a couple of hundred years, there was a lot of dereliction. So the central parts were still used and were still available, but a lot of the outside areas and the outside passageways and things were destroyed and had the roof taken off. And then it was the 1850s and the 1860s. There was another big period of ecclesiastical building. Gilbert Scott got involved at that stage and really unveiled and literally had dug out of different parts of the building things that had been filled in and covered up during the Reformation period. So some of what we can see around the cathedral today is because Gilbert Scott came and said, I think there might be something or other there behind that wall. Have a dig around before I come back on my next visit, as architects do.
Fantastic.
Came back on his next visit and said, oh, wow, look what we found, look what we found. So we were very lucky that he was in that frame of mind.
Yes.
And he was able to reveal a lot that had been covered up in the Reformation.
Yeah, okay. Now, there's a royal coat of arms over there. What's that all about? Is that to do with visiting royalty, or what's that?
That's really because there's been, since Dewi's time, there's been a royal connection here. Dewi himself was of a royal family. His father was probably the king of Ceredigion. What people tend to know about Dewi's patronage is that his parents weren't married. And that his father forced himself on his mother, St. Non. And they overlooked the fact that it was the royal father that he had. So there'd been then a royal patronage here, and of David and of his work, from the 6th century, from the beginnings of this place. And the princes and the royalty of South Wales were the patrons here. One of the main princes of South Wales, Dyfed Bath, in the 12th century, Radloedd Rhys. Lord Rhys is buried here, and his son is buried here, and other members of the family. So there were royal connections throughout the time. And then come the Reformation, and Thomas Cromwell and others basically trying to monetize everything that they could get their hands on. The representation of the royal link then became sort of firmed up in making one of the curcels, one of the stalls and the seats in the choir area here. That was then allocated to the king, and the income from it for a short period went to the king as well. So the royal stall dates back to Tudor times and to the Reformation time, but the royal connection and what it was based on goes back even further. So that seat there can only be used, can only be sat in by the monarch at any one time.
And you've ever been tempted to go and try and sit in it?
Certainly not. What a suggestion. And you're not going to it. the only monarch so far who has actually sat there was Queen Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth II.
So she came.
She's been here four times different events. So the coat of arms that you spotted on there is Queen Elizabeth II's coat of arms. Prince Charles, Prince of Wales at the time, was here a couple of years ago, and he couldn't sit there, but he walked past it. And next time he comes,
he'll
be entitled to sit there.
So that
is unique.
Can I ask if the rest of the choir stalls are Tudor? There's some lovely misery chords as well, I noticed. So what age are we talking about?
These are late 14th century.
Right.
The misery chords and the carving and most of these. Some of them, again, were replicated where they were badly damaged by Gilbert Scott as replicas. And they are gorgeous. As you say, should we go up and have a look?
Yes, let's have. I absolutely love them. I always make sure I take some photos of the misery chords wherever I... Oh, wonderful. We're just getting to go right up into the stalls and have a look at them all.
And they were called misery chords because it's a derivation from the Latin for mercy. So we're all now naturally
sitting.
Leaning on them.
Yes.
Sort of sitting, sort of standing. And if you think of the medieval monks who were here and in the 14th century when these were carved and built, they wouldn't have had just two services a day or three services a day on a Sunday or so. They would have had six, seven, even eight. So it would have been virtually all day. Mm. And some of them were not as young as they used to be. And so sitting as we are now, sort of part leaning, part sitting, meant that they were still showing respect.
Yes.
They weren't... just sitting down on the job.
Yes.
But that they could keep going. And so there was a pragmatic background to the design as well. But also they don't have... and then the seat can come down as well. And therefore it's hidden a lot of the time. So they don't have religious symbolism on them.
I see.
They will often be slightly satirical.
Oh, they're funny, aren't they?
They will be based on local life. So there's a couple over here that are showing pilgrims coming by boat.
Uh-huh.
And there's one of them that it could just be one of the pilgrims leaning over the edge. But we were always brought up to believe he was being seasick.
Okay.
which he probably was.
And you get some fantastic mythical beasts, don't you?
You
and
do. That's a green man there. There's a few green men.
Yes.
This is my favourite. This is Reynard the Fox.
Oh, right.
And this is probably one of the earliest depictions of Reynard, because this was very, very soon after the first English translations of the Reynard stories came to Britain from Belgium. And this was quite soon after. And we quite like Reynard.
He's lovely.
Yes.
He's lovely. There are just so many of them, aren't there?
There's a dragon, of course.
Is there a dragon? Oh, what's this chappy doing? Oh, this is like a deer that looks like... What's this? Oh, it's something swallowing a man. Is that a...
Yes, there's a bit of that. Well, he could be a dragon, or he could be something. But you're right. The top half of the man has disappeared down his gullet.
He's just got his little legs.
Yeah, I think he's a man.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, I love them. Right, I better come out.
There's a couple of angels over there, and there's also there's some snakes and a dragon, and there's some pigs doing something rather nasty to a to a boar, I think it is.
Do you think that the craftsmen were given free range then for to carve these undersides
I don't
of
know
the seats?
Quite, because some of them do have messages and resonant with relevant local life and local stories. So there was probably something intentional there as well. Yes, and there are some gorgeous misery chords around the country, but we're very lucky to have almost a full set
remaining here. It's beautiful.
This is an area that we use all the time. There'll be Evensong here this evening. There'll be Evensong. When anyone comes, just check what time Evensong is. And the choir will be sitting in these. And there's usually a couple of seats in the misery chords that are available for people to sit in, as well as the clergy will be up there for some of them. And then Yeah, there's often places if they're free, you might be able to sit up here.
Yeah, yeah,
that's
fantastic.
Yeah. Now, we also have here,
yes,
which I didn't tell you about, Sarah, when you were cricking your neck to look at the tower, a mirror,
which
enables people. So people should look for this when they come. Yeah. But it also shows you the fabulous design of the cross up there on the painted wood.
It's lovely. Mm. Okay. Well, having walked our way through the choir and enjoyed looking at these fabulous 14th century stalls, I think that's bringing us towards the sort of Wars of the Roses, and there is a very important tomb that you have here in St David's, which we have come right to now. So can you tell us who is buried in this chest tomb? And what's the story?
Okay, so this is Edmund Tudor, who was the father of the Tudor dynasty. He was the father of Henry VII, the grandfather of Henry VIII, and he died of the plague in Carmarthen. And the story is, you said Wars of the Roses, and it was a skirmish during the Wars of the Roses when he was captured and imprisoned in the prison under what was then Carmarthen Castle. And then he died, he caught the plague there, probably not a very healthy place at all,
well,
caught
exactly.
the plague and died.
Not great
which,
for your health.
Which was probably a huge embarrassment at the time, because they were only meant to be capturing him. And so he was buried probably quite quickly in the chapel to the Greyfriars there in Carmarthen. When he died, his young wife, Margaret Beaufort, was she 13?
13.
And she was pregnant. But he died in the November. And, of course, Henry VII, as he became, wasn't born until early the next year. So... this is Henry VII's father, who Henry VII never knew, never met. Really sad story. And then when Henry VII became king, he had a proper tomb built in Greyfriars in Carmarthen for his father. But then, you know, Henry VIII came along, and what do you do when you're told to destroy Greyfriars in Carmarthen? But the king's grandfather is buried there. Well, long story short, he was moved 80 years after he died and was first buried to St David's Cathedral and reburied here. And that's the tomb that we're looking at. Some of it may still be the original Purbeck marble. We're not totally sure. There were lots of descriptions of this fabulous brass effigy of Henry VII here, which is easy to see now and is a lovely face.
I think you said Henry VII's effigy. Do you want to do that again? Just save trying to cut it out.
there's a lovely brass depiction here of Edmund Tudor, with his face very clearly, and with the red dragon on his headdress. And that's very easy to see. People can come and see this here. And when I was small, I remember there used to be a step all the way around the outside of this. And we were allowed to do brass rubbings of him and to take them home with us, and we held them over his face. But that's not allowed anymore.
And this brass, is it a later brass?
Very much so, yes. There had been several over the years, but there was a description of the inscription, which is in Latin at the time. And so this particular one is probably 1830s, 1840s. However, the interesting thing was that when the tomb was brought here or reconstructed here or whatever exactly happened, there was this inscription in brass added right round the outside.
Yes.
And this is in English, which wouldn't have happened at the time of his death. And this is where the Tudor instinct for branding really shows through, because between every word is this gorgeous little brass Tudor rose.
That's wonderful. And this is Tudor, this inscription,
yeah,
all the way around is
Tudor.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And it says...
Yes, tell us what it says. Can we read all the way around it?
Yes, we can. It's in English. The script is a Gothic-style script, so it can seem hard to read. But it says, under this marble stone here interred rest the bones of that noble lord, Edmund. Here we are, Edmund, Earl of Richmond, father and brother to kings. So the father and brother to kings, that was another key part of the Tudor spin. Mm. So when he died, they didn't know he was going to be father to Henry VII.
No.
And the brother to kings, that's a very, very quick way of describing the relationship with Henry VI.
Yeah, right.
So father and brother to kings, the which departed out of this world in the year of our Lord God, 1456, the first day of the month of November. Now, that word there is first. A lot of Tudor historians will say that Edmund Tudor died on the 3rd of November. And every year on the 1st of November, when we remember him in various ways, we will have various Tudor historians, some of whom will be listening to now, saying, no, it wasn't the 1st, it wasn't the 1st, it was the 3rd of November. Well, we don't know. We genuinely don't know. What we do know is that on his tomb, it says the 1st of November.
Right.
So the 1st of the month of November, on whose soul almighty Jesu have mercy, amen.
Fantastic.
So that fits exactly all the way around. Well, you do think they might have changed, you know, expanded the wording to make sure it all fits.
Maybe they did. That would take so much drafting.
And you can see that at any time when you come around.
And do we know if his body is in the tomb or is it buried under the ground?
No, as far as we know, it was buried in the tomb. When it came here, bones have been seen over the years in there.
Not recently.
Right. We haven't opened it. We tend not to open tombs all the time.
No, but the Georgians and Victorians were very good at that. I've found that out through my various researching of various royal tombs that have been opened.
Yes, we don't have a crypt here.
Right.
We have boggy land underneath.
So
a crypt was not possible. And it's not so boggy now, because we've talked about some of the architecture and some of the beautiful, fabulous things that Gilbert Scott did. But perhaps the most important thing he did was built massive great drains underneath. Again, practicality. And that meant that a lot of the moisture in the water was taken away and helped stabilise the building. But it also means that there's no crypt here, not like in St Paul's or something.
Interesting. Very good.
You have been listening to the first part of this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. The remainder of this episode is only available to members of my membership site, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England. To join the waitlist to become a member of The Ultimate Guide, click on the link in the description associated with this podcast. You will be added to the waiting list and I will email you just as soon as the doors to the membership next reopen. I'll see you there. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling!